Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 605, interview with Dean McLeod and Peter Vogel about Port Chicago. This has been recorded on August 5th of the year 2007. Once again, it is my pleasure to welcome back to our airwaves Peter Vogel, and it is my pleasure to welcome to our airwaves for the first time Dean McLeod. They are respectively the authors of the online book The Last Wave from Port Chicago and Images of America, Port Chicago. Gentlemen, welcome to our airwaves.
Oh, thanks very much, Dave. It's so good to be back with you.
And thanks, David. It's glad to talk with you.
Well, we are now, as I'm speaking, on August 5th of 2007. This is a time of year when people pause and reflect on the only two times that an atomic weapon was used in warfare, namely the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As we will see, there is very good evidence, developed first by Peter Vogel, that in fact this is not the first time that an atomic device was used on human beings. We'll get into that later. But the Port Chicago explosion, and I'm going to encapsulate a very important event and the ramifications of it. Gentlemen, anything you feel needs to be added, please do. But in the interest of time, on July 17th of 1944, an ammunition ship, the E.A. Bryan, exploded at Port Chicago Naval Weapons Center, Naval Munitions Depot, and the resulting loss of life and devastation and the handling of the situation both before and after the explosion by naval personnel led African-American sailors to mutiny. The handling of weapons being loaded for the war in the Pacific at the Port Chicago Naval Weapons Depot was largely done by African-American sailors, and after the explosion, many of them mutinied and were, in the opinion of many, unfairly convicted and stigmatized for that mutiny. Ultimately, the case was heard by Thurgood Marshall, who became ultimately the first African-American Supreme Court judge. And in time, those convictions were commuted, and the initial view of the mutineers as basically no good and what do you expect from, quote, those people has dramatically turned around. And Port Chicago and that mutiny and the subsequent reversal of the verdicts has become a focal point and something of a landmark in the development of African-American civil rights and the African-American civil rights struggle, which was to blossom in the 50s and 60s. That is the main context in which Port Chicago and the Port Chicago explosion have come to be known. But what we're going to do in this broadcast is to talk a little bit more about just not only what took place with the explosion, but more about Port Chicago itself and what it was all about. Gentlemen, do you think that there's anything that needs to be added to my little synopsis there?
I think that's very well done, Dave. I think you've encapsulated it very well. Dean, is there something you'd like to put in at this point?
Yes. I have, based on my research, come to conclude that there are really three very large stories at Port Chicago. The mutiny and all of the ramifications of that is one of those stories. My book focuses on two other stories, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk about some of those.
Well, why don't you give us quickly the subjects, those two.
Dean, before you do, mention once again the title of your book, which is due for publication, if I'm correct, on September 15th of this year.
That's correct. It's Images of America, Port Chicago, and it's going to be published by Arcadia Publishing. It's primarily a pictorial history, but the introductions have a considerable amount of meat, much of it which has not ever been published before. The two other big stories really are a consequence of the underwriting story, which I believe is the nuclear history of the Pacific Coast. And the final story, which my book focuses quite a bit on, is the story of the eviction of the people of the town of Port Chicago during the Vietnam War. This is a story that's largely unknown.
Dean, very quickly, for people that aren't familiar with the Bay Area, California, tell us a little bit about Port Chicago, Suisun Bay, the Concord Naval Weapons Center. Place this geographically for us so people have some idea of where we're talking about.
Yes. Port Chicago was a town in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area in Suisun Bay, fed by the Sacramento Rivers, so that it's deeply inland from the main bay, protected from the ocean by some 30 miles of bays. Port Chicago was a small town that was originally a company town. It was created in 1908, and most of the townspeople were imported for the timber industry. There was a very large lumber yard there, and it became an industrial center, one of the most industrial places in Contra Costa County.
By the way, Suisun Bay is spelled S-U-S-S-U-I-S-U-N for people that look it up. This whole area is surrounded by mountains, too, which perhaps we'll have a chance to talk about later. Continue, Dean.
I think the other story that's of significance is the nuclear story. And I think that is, of course, going to be talked about some today. But I think that most people don't understand that that nuclear story went on for probably 60 years at Port Chicago, beyond the explosion that's famous.
Tell us about that history. How is Port Chicago a nuclear city in that context?
It was the primary transshipment center for munitions, all munitions from the West Coast, from World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the Gulf Wars. And so, therefore, all modern weapons that were transshipped from the to the Pacific from the West Coast, a majority of them came from Port Chicago.
So in other words, Port Chicago is the naval installation on the West Coast of the United States that was the point of departure slash entry for all intents and purposes for nuclear weapons that were going to be deployed in the Pacific theater during the Cold War.
That's correct.
I'm going to put in here just an added note here that Port Chicago, the town, as well as the military establishment there, is about 32 miles northeast of San Francisco. And it at the time that the base was established in 1942, I believe it was a fairly remote area there and was separated from the larger community of Concord by a row of hills, and was essentially in an area which was without a human population except the small town of Port Chicago. The area was also served by three intercontinental or transcontinental railroads, and it was on those railroads that the munitions were shipped to Port Chicago from munition bases across the country, some of them primarily in Utah. And it was those railroad facilities that was, you know, primarily the reason that Port Chicago was situated where it was.
So in other words, it was a railhead which served as an embarkation point for shipborne cargoes, and in particular nuclear ones during the Cold War.
That's exactly right. The other reason, of course, for the existence of the town was the deep water port that had been used since Spanish times.
And basically this was, and as such, it was a port where significant merchant bottoms, ships which could hold significant tonnage, could sail relatively far inland.
Absolutely, yes.
Because they had
I believe it was something like 35 feet deep at the dock.
Now, Dean, in your book, Images of America, Port Chicago, you chronicle the history of Port Chicago, and in particular, some of the things that happened to people who lived there as its status as the number one seaborne, at least, embarkation point for nuclear weapons coalesced during the Cold War. Tell us about that, if you would.
As the nuclear world developed, and particularly as the transshipment began in greater earnest, and I don't have absolute information about all of the details, but I believe that it really began to be built up approximately 1952. And from 1952 until 1968, this became more and more important as a transshipment center. And at the same time, the town was attempting to grow. This created the conflict, essential conflict, between the needs of the military establishment and the needs of the community. Consequently, especially during the 50s and 60s, there was a slow economic and political strangulation of the community, and eventually the people were evicted from the town, lock, stock, and barrel, in 1968. during the Vietnam War.
The reason for that ostensibly was to provide a buffer zone around the Port Chicago facility in the event that another large explosion would occur, such as the one that did occur at Port Chicago on July 17, 1944. But I've heard rumors said that the Navy, that the concept of a buffer zone was really a cover for the idea that the Navy just really wanted the town out of there.
Well, I think that's true, and it was done on, you know, under the cover of protecting the people for the repeat of a World War II type explosion. Of course, the thing that's not talked about too much is that if the weapons were to explode, if there was a nuclear explosion, you needed a much larger buffer zone than 2 miles.
Dean, what year specifically did the eviction of the residents of Port Chicago take place? And remember from a listener audience that this is a town full of American citizens who were just basically picked up and shipped out.
Well, it took place in the summer of 1968. They began eminent domain proceedings in the prior year. It was part of a larger military budget proposal, and I've looked at that budget, and if you examine, like military budgets today, it was just a tiny little footnote in the overall military budget. And so from the large perspective, it isn't something that would jump out and grab you. It was just simply a real estate acquisition. Of course, if you look at the micro level and you look at the community that's been there since 1908, some 3,500 people with their churches and their schools and their businesses and their homes that some of them had lived in for three generations, it was a much bigger thing for them.
So basically, it is 1968, right in the middle of all of the social turmoil, the protests against the Vietnam War, and also the very turbulent period in the civil rights history that period was, that all of this took place. That is to say, the eviction, the eminent domain appropriation of the actual town of Port Chicago.
Yes, if one were to look at the historical record, the newspaper accounts, it was a national story at the time, even though it was, you know, being drowned out by many other political and social and military movements at the time. The Port Chicago eviction was national news for a number of years.
Did the people, were they moved sort of en masse? Did they become sort of like a Port Chicago city in exile, or did they pretty much scatter? Did they all kind of find their own vectors in life, so to speak, and scattered by the prevailing wind, so to speak?
Well, they were given the option of taking their homes with them, and some of them actually did move their homes on trucks and moved them into the nearby vicinity of West Pittsburgh. In my book, I have a photograph that shows a row of houses going down the Port Chicago Highway being shipped away. The majority of the people moved to into new homes in the vicinity in Contra Costa County, although now they're scattered all over the United States. I think the really important thing that makes the book of some interest is that these people maintain their sense of community and have a reunion every summer. They have now for 39 years.
So in other words, there's kind of like a Port Chicago, you know, in exile alumni association.
Exactly. Something like that, or something like a family reunion of an extended family of a town that has a long, deep history of intercommunication, intermarriage, and it's really quite unique history.
Just a point of curiosity, Dean and Peter, maybe this is irrelevant. What caused the town to be called Port Chicago in the first place? Was it the railhead connection? Because, of course, Port Chicago is a major railhead. Or Chicago, the city of Chicago is a major rail center. Was that it? I'm just curious, what led to the actual naming of the town?
Well, the town originally was called Bay Point when it was created, and it was named after the larger school district that covered a much larger area. Two sections of the school district were not incorporated, but platted out by the Smith Lumber Company, and they called it Bay Point.
Mm-hmm.
as the Depression came along in 1931, in order to save business, to enhance business, the Chamber of Commerce and the town leaders decided that they needed to have a complete overhaul of their image. And since industry was the backbone of a town, they chose the name Chicago. The postmaster said that they couldn't use that name, and so they ended up calling it Port Chicago.
Okay. Well, now we know where the name comes from. I would note for people, too, the town actually began in 1908. That was 2 years after the earthquake. A lot of cities, you mentioned that lumbering, logging was a major factor in the early growth of the town. A lot of towns in the Bay Area did grow up around logging because the 06 earthquake created a tremendous market for lumber, and the redwoods were some of the Bay Area lost a lot of its redwoods. It was to rebuilding San Francisco and environs after the quake. Again, Dean, you mentioned that this area, again, Port Chicago, the Port Chicago Naval Munitions Depot, was the primary embarkation point for nuclear weapons headed to the Pacific Theater during the Cold War. Can you perhaps preview your book a little bit for us? What sorts of detail are available in the book? Could you flesh that out a little more for us and give us a little more understanding of just what was actually taking place at that base in this time period that we're talking about?
Are you talking about the World War II period or during the Cold War period?
During the Cold War period, when it became the primary embarkation point for nuclear weapons.
Well, I think it began I just learned recently that the first nuclear sub was constructed just across the bay at Mare Island in 1952. And it was at that time that I believe that it became the central point for it. This has been really pretty much secret information, top secret information. I think the Navy, even today, isn't interested in talking too much about the facility and about the growth of it. It takes some serious digging to really get a sense of the extent of it. We do know that the inland portion of the base with some 7,000 acres. That ground covered all types of munitions. This was only simply one of the types of munitions that were sent overseas.
Mm-hmm. So it was not exclusively nuclear munitions. There was a wide variety of ordnance that was moving through Port Chicago.
Exactly. And most of the statistics and numbers that I've seen indicate that some 70% of munitions overall, all types of munitions for the major wars that went to the Pacific Theater went through Port Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps this is I'm asking for a subjective judgment, but Dean, do you think that the timing of the eviction of the residents of Port Chicago had anything to do with the trend toward civil disobedience, attempting to block military facilities that were supporting the Vietnam War, and perhaps concern on the part of naval authorities that people of that bent might get their hands on or somehow disrupt nuclear operations in that area?
I don't really think so. Those things came later. Surprisingly, the people of Port Chicago, they were blue-collar workers. They were not liberals. They were not protesters. They didn't get into the business of protesting at all until the Navy told them that they were going to have to leave and that their property was going to be taken. Those war protests were actually a later movement that came after the town had been evicted.
Okay.
And they continued for a generation.
Mm-hmm.
I want to step in here with a little note here. The transshipment of nuclear weapons would not have been an exclusive province of Port Chicago. I mean, it's just unlikely that one transshipment point would be used continuously. I mean, the idea with nuclear weapons is that you mix up everybody by shipping them first one place then another place so that nobody really knows where they are. It's a big shell game. And although I'm persuaded that nuclear weapons were transshipped through Port Chicago, I don't think that by any means it was the exclusive only transshipment facility.
If I said exclusive, I didn't mean that. I meant the primary. Not that it was the only one, but my understanding, Dean, is that it was the main one, according to your research.
Well, I can tell you definitively that it was the main West Coast transshipment center for munitions of all types.
Okay. Okay. Talking about nuclear weapons and by way perhaps of affecting something of a transition to some earlier discussion, which we talked about Port Chicago and the Port Chicago explosion in the context of the development of nuclear weapons. Well, Peter, you developed initially in your article for the Black Scholar in 1982, the last wave from Port Chicago article that began this exploration. And one of the pieces of evidence you cited in your initial exploration of the Port Chicago explosion was a piece of film which was, as I recall, correct me if I'm wrong here, that was actually justified, this film of a Port Chicago-like explosion, was supposedly a mock-up that was being presented in order to show the relative advantages of Port Chicago as a facility that the Navy wanted to appropriate.
That's correct, Dave. There was a film. I learned I was out at the Port Chicago facility in 1981. Speaking to Dan Tikalski, the public affairs officer out there, and I was just talking to him about Port Chicago, and I said, well, you know, I actually am of the opinion, Dan, that the explosion at Port Chicago in 1944 was, in fact, a nuclear fission explosion that had been conducted purposefully by the Manhattan Project and the Navy. And he, at that point, he got up, kind of went out of the room, came back, and sat down again, and he said, well, we have a film of the Port Chicago explosion. And I said, well, I'd very much like to see that film because if it is, in fact, an actual record of the Port Chicago explosion, it would be impossible that that would be a film documentary which had been done without knowing in advance that an explosion was going to occur at 10:30 that evening. So he then, that is Dan Tikalski, who's since passed on, you know, an honorable man whom I greatly admired, he then said that it was a nitrate-based film and that the film could not be taken out of the Port Chicago Public Affairs Office safe because it would disintegrate because it was nitrate-based. And therefore, I couldn't see the film. And I learned a few months later that portions of that film had actually been incorporated into a KQED, that's a public television station in San Francisco, into a film that KQED had made several years earlier, that is, before 1981, which is called Broken Arrow. And I got a copy of that film, Broken Arrow, from KQED, and I looked at it, and the explosion sequence shows a massive fireball, and it shows fragments from an explosion just being thrown off at enormous distances as a measure of time. And so then I was even more persuaded, you know, that this is probably a film that actually shows the explosion at Port Chicago and therefore had to have been anticipated. And, you know, I published that in the Black Scholar article in 1982, and that continued to haunt Dan Tikalski at Port Chicago until he retired in 1994. And he finally, that is, Dan Tikalski finally said, you know, the film, the original film, has been destroyed, and it's been transferred to videotape. And so the original film is not there, and we cannot, therefore, determine whether it was nitrate-based film. If it were nitrate-based film, it would necessarily have been made prior to 1952.
Which was when the film was supposedly made, right?
Yes, the film supposedly was made in 1967 to support the Navy's contention that the town of Port Chicago should be acquired by eminent domain and taken over.
Okay, so it is directly relevant then to Dean's research on the relocation of the citizens of Port Chicago.
That is so. The film, which has this footage of the explosion, was made specifically by the Navy. I think it was an independent contractor rather than the Navy itself that made the film. And it was made to show specifically to members of the United States Congress and to the public of Concord and that area of Port Chicago and Bay Point to persuade the local residents that it was necessary and imperative that the Navy acquire this property as a buffer zone to protect the local environment in the case of another large explosion.
Mm-hmm.
It was a propaganda film Now, whether that film actually includes footage of the Port Chicago film or Port Chicago explosion, I have come to doubt. One of the main reasons I doubt that is because Dan Tikowski, before he died, told me that, Peter, the film is gone. You're never going to be able to find out whether or not it was nitrate-based film. In my opinion, it was a mock-up of an explosion. The actual fireball is stock footage that the Navy or the producer of the film had found and inserted into the film as an example of what would happen in the event of a large explosion. So I don't, at this point, I really don't think it was, that it includes footage of the Port Chicago explosion. And one of the reasons I don't think so, Dave, is because I don't think the Navy and Los Alamos and the Manhattan Project would have been silly enough to make footage of an explosion if they knew it was going to happen. Because eventually it would get out and somebody would say, well, why is this film of an explosion out there? Because you would have to have known it was going to happen. I just don't think that the Navy would have made that film, or Los Alamos. And in another way, it was really unnecessary to have that film, because what really was the main criteria for the people at Los Alamos was the formation of the ball of fire.
Mm-hmm. I would note, though, simply in passing, that if in point of fact it had been nitrate-based film, it would have precluded the possibility of that film having been made in 52, because nitrate-based film, highly flammable, was phased out well before then.
That's exactly so.
And gentlemen, we're almost out of time on this side. Excuse me for butting in, but I'd like each of you to promote both your books and your websites, and in your case, Peter, a bit of a qualification, because there's been a little bit of a hitch with your website as we talk on August 5th of 07. Gentlemen, your websites and your books, and we're going to continue with this discussion on side two.
Why don't you go ahead, Dean? I'm really anxious to note this down. I'm looking forward to your website.
Well, we just published the website an hour ago, although I've been working on it for quite some time, and the material, much of it comes from my book as well as previous researches that I've done. The web page is web.mac, that's M-A-C, .com/Dean, D-E-A-N, _McLeod, M-C-L-E-O-D, .mac.
Dot Mac, is that?
That's right, dot Mac. And it has much more detail than we've been able to talk about today, and it's a pretty good introduction to the book, which is Images of America, Port Chicago. I also probably could indicate that the book is coming out September 15th, and that a lot of the material, some of the material is included in the previous book that I wrote called Images of America, Bay Point. It has different material, but it's also relevant to the same story of the town.
And by the way, your last name, McLeod, is capital M-C, capital L-E-O-D, for
That's
people
right.
that want to do a little internet searching on that. Peter, your website, your book, and the qualification.
Right. The Last Wave from Port Chicago is at www.portchicago.org. Portchicago.org. Unfortunately, the website is put up by the Contra Costa County Office of Education in California, and that website has been down over the weekend, but I anticipate that it's going to be up early next week and running again.
Okay, so for the time being, the website is down, but it's going to reappear very shortly.
Yes.
Okay. Well, this concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 605, interview with Peter Vogel and Dean McLeod about Port Chicago. This program is being recorded on August 5th of the year 2007, and we're going to be revisiting with Peter Vogel and Dean McLeod on Side 2. For Dean McLeod and Peter Vogel, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.